Welcome, committee members. Apologize for being a little bit late today, and welcome to those of you in the audience. We'll open today's public hearing with a public hearing on Senate Bill 10A. And Jim, do you want to read us a staff summary, please?
I will. Thank you. Senate Bill 10A changes the residency requirements for purposes of determining tuition at Oregon University System Institutions of Higher Education. It specifies that a student is considered a resident if the student has resided in Oregon with a parent or legal guardian for at least 3 consecutive years while attending a secondary school, has received a high school diploma or its equivalent from an Oregon secondary school, and plans to become a citizen or legal resident alien. Applies beginning in the 2004-05 school year.
Thank you very much. I see that Senator Courtney is here, that Representative Dalto is here. Senator Courtney, would you like to begin?
Well, I would, Jim, I'd like to refer to the House members before the August House Education Committee, if I could.
That would be acceptable. Representative Dalto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Billy Dalto, State Representative, Oregon, House District 21. I'd like to begin by saying on the record how much I am appreciative of Senator Courtney and his fine staff bringing this bill to my attention. It's an important bill, and I'm excited that I've had the opportunity to work on it for some time now. Many of you know. Senate Bill 10 is a very important bill. I'd like to explain to you what it does, because I think there are a lot of sort of emotions running high on a bill like this. But it's important that we let facts, and that is fact, come and explain this bill. Senate Bill 10 increases access to our public higher education system for some folks that don't already have it. Let me describe the 2 categories of people that Senate Bill 10 affects. The first category of student is the student who is an American citizen. The student who was born here in Oregon, attended school all their lives in Oregon, was successful in their schooling to the point that they were accepted in a competitive process for admission to a public university. And when they get to a public university, they find out they can't get in-state tuition. And the reason why they can't get in-state tuition, even though they're a citizen, is because the Oregon University System's rules dictate that the way they consider it, they are considering the residency status of the parents. And for that first category of student, that student has parents that don't have legal status for whatever reason. And so in my diligence in working this bill, I couldn't find anybody that would explain to me or that felt that an American citizen who is a lifelong resident of Oregon shouldn't be able to go to an Oregon college at the in-state tuition rate. And so the problem is with the second category of student. Now, I'll explain to you one type of student or one situation with that second category, and that is, let's say you have a student who was born to a migrant family and was brought here at a very young age and has attended school K through 12, you know, all their lives in an Oregon school, has received a high school diploma and has applied for admittance into a public university and has gotten admitted. That student cannot get the in-state tuition rate. And so that's what this bill does. This bill allows both categories of students to get the in-state tuition rate to one of Oregon schools. It does not allow the student to get access to the Oregon Opportunity Grant or any sort of scholarships, be they state or federal, that are public in nature, because the student doesn't have legal status and therefore is not eligible for one of those sort of considerations. And so ultimately this is a bill about access. And the message that we're sending to folks, you know, we have a real lack of continuity between our elementary education policy and our higher education policy. We say, and granted the federal government dictates this, but we say we educate all comers, no matter what your background is, no matter who you are, and no matter what condition you might come in. We have a responsibility and a moral obligation to educate all students in this state. And I know the representative who chairs this committee has worked very hard to, I think, widen lower the mandatory minimum age, I think, for a student to have to go to school, because we want kids in school. And so that's what this bill does. And so the lack of continuity comes, well, you've gone to K through 12, You've gone to school in Oregon all your life, and then you get to college, and there's a big sign that says, you know what? You're not welcome. You can't participate. You've gotten this far, but you can't go on. And that's where the lack of continuity is. Why do we have a disconnect between higher education policy and K through 12 education policy? What is the disconnect, and what kind of message are we sending to those people that are the students that are in that position? And so Senate Bill 10 corrects what I think is a huge flaw in our education policy. And make no mistake, there are emotions run high when we talk about issues of citizenship and legal status and things like that. But please understand that Senate Bill 10, we are not going to solve in the House Education Committee in the Oregon Legislature the problem of federal immigration and the flaws that mar our federal immigration system. There are flaws, and in my opinion, federal immigration policy is fatally flawed. But Senate Bill 10 does nothing to address federal immigration policy. Senate Bill 10 allows a group of students who want to go on to college to let them go on to college in a way that they can get that access. And you know, there's the issue will come out. We'll have a discussion about the difference in cost between in-state tuition and out-of-state tuition. And so the good people of Oregon have decided long ago that they would essentially subsidize the cost of an education in a public university, because we want an educated society. We want bright, capable people for our neighbors and for our workforce. And so Senate Bill 10 broadens that pool and allows everybody who's educated in Oregon, regardless of their legal status, even though they are educated in Oregon, to go and have that same access. And I submit to you that each of the members on this panel are parents. I'm not a parent, but each of you are, and you've loved and nurtured your children as they've become students, and you've supported them as they've sought higher education. And I submit that it doesn't matter where you come from, parents are the same, no matter what the citizenship is or the legal status. They want the same for their children as we want for our children. And so I ask you to, as you listen to the testimony, start to think about separating this issue from the problems of the federal system and our education policy in Oregon. What is our education policy in Oregon? Just think about that and the message that we sent. And so I'm going to turn it over to Senator Courtney, but I think this is a very powerful issue that we're talking about. Access is huge, and right now a lot of the students who are facing this situation, who cannot go on with the in-state tuition, they won't be able to go to college. Simply as that. It's as simple as that. I mean, the $15,000 out-of-state tuition, or $14,000 or $16,000, whatever it is, might as well be $15, $16 million, because nothing they can do will put them in a position to be able to afford that education. And so this is ultimately an access issue. And I would say for the folks that are concerned about how much is it going to cost, well, let's hear from the Oregon University system, the experts, to see what they say. And if my understanding is correct, they're going to tell us that this applies to a very small number of students, and that they do not put a fiscal impact, because they do not expect that there will be a huge fiscal impact on this. And to the extent that there is a fiscal impact, the university system will absorb it, and they'll be appreciative to get the increased the additional tuitions from these students that they would be paying. And so I would ask you to keep an open mind in this hearing, and hear from everybody on all sides, and consider supporting this bill. So thank you very much for indulging me, Senator Clinton.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Backman, Vice Chair Hobson, Representative Vaughn, Representative Farr, Representative Scott, and it's my privilege and privilege to be before the House Education Committee today to speak in support of Senate Bill 10. I don't know. I would hope that you have copies of my written testimony. In addition, as I speak, copies of the question and answer statement we prepared for the members of the Senate is also being copied to be given to you. We tried to identify those questions, particularly those very difficult questions that were being asked about this piece of legislation, and we tried to come up with meaningful answers. So with that document, I don't believe it is before you. It's being copied. It will be before you. In fact, it's now coming to you now. Thank you very much.
very simply put, it's my understanding that a teenage boy or girl who goes to school here in Oregon, particularly the high school here in Oregon, and has completed their studies and graduates, has a high school diploma or equivalent thereof, they then apply to one of our seven, actually I guess it's eight now, depending upon the status of Ben's college, seven or eight public universities, and they are admitted because they meet the requirements of those respective schools. They then learn that they will have to pay out-of-state tuition, or what we call foreign student tuition. Now, and the reason is because they were not born in Oregon or this country, or they were born in Oregon or this country, but their parents do not have legal papers. Now, the difference in tuition, and I can speak from experience on this, since I have a son at Western Oregon University, as I speak to you as well as I work there, as of this moment, and this is changing all the time, my fellow legislators, I believe I can roughly say, Chair Bachman, that at this time a term for one of our respective universities, public, is about $1,400 for in-state, $1,400, and about $5,300 for out-of-state per term. The academic year is, we are on a term system here in the state of Oregon. We're not on a semester, so you have three terms every academic year. So you're talking three times 1,400 versus three times 5,300. And I can tell you, the vast majority of the young men and women that are attending our public universities today that are paying in-state tuition, they could not attend or would find it prohibitive if they had to pay this out-of-state tuition. I'm just going to make that statement. I cannot scientifically prove that, but I would suggest they could not afford one of these public universities if they had to pay out-of-state tuition. To be sure, the young men and women we're talking about, it's just prohibitive. They've already achieved something that few of any in their families will ever achieve. They have a high school diploma. They have a high school diploma. A lot of us, I think, take that for granted. They have already gotten a high school diploma. Please understand, and I have here a copy, and I'm in front of at least two individuals, and I'm not familiar, Representative Farr, Representative Scott, or Representative Arkin, with your backgrounds, as much as I am with Representative Backlund and Representative Hobson. These two are, let's just say, educational, primary school, middle school, high school giants in our state. They have taught there, they have coached there, they have administered there. They know this only too well. ORS 339.010 to ORS 339.990 require every student in this state, every child in this state, regardless of status, to go to school, to attend school. It requires their parents or guardian to make sure they go to school, attend school. Any and all children ages of 5, 6 years of age through 18. If that is not the case, there is a violation levied against them. So we're talking about young people that are in our schools because we require them to be in our school regardless of where they were born, in-state, out-of-state, in-country, out-of-country. Not only that, many of these young people, not all, are very involved in those schools. They are on those athletic teams. They're in the band. They're out for class plays, on the speech team. They work hard on the yearbook. They hold class offices. They're very proud individuals. They have learned the English language or they wouldn't be able to get the diploma. They are also very involved in their community. This piece of legislation would say to those individuals, should they get that diploma or their equivalent, should they get into one of those universities, that as long as they attended that high school for at least 3 years, they have the diploma, and if they aren't legal residents or citizens already, they must pledge to pursue such status. That's what this bill says. The bill was pioneered in the states of Texas and California. Texas and California. Both states, if you review the legislative record, you will find out something that's very amazing. The vote for the pieces of legislation in Texas, which requires just 1 year in their schools, California requires 3 years, was overwhelmingly bipartisan. Bipartisan. It wasn't a Democrat thing or Republican thing. Together, both parties in the House and the Senate in those two states, and I'm not saying because they did it, we did it, but to be sure, it was not viewed as a partisan issue. It was an issue viewed as fairness. Now, Senate Bill 10 is not about special privileges. It is not about special privileges. It will not prevent or displace Oregon resident students from our public universities. It does not take money from one group and give it to another. Oregon University Systems officials are here to testify today about these matters because questions came to me on this. They're here to answer those two questions. Will Oregon kids today that are residents here be displaced by this bill? No. The answer is no. They're being here to testify on this. Senate Bill 10 is about helping young people get a college education by removing economic roadblocks. Education is the key to personal growth and opportunity. It's also the key to economic recovery and future of our state. You are the House Education Committee, and you are the House's leaders for good education, access to that good education. Senate Bill 10 is about education, it's about access, and it's also about fairness. Senate Bill 10 kids have worked hard, have studied hard, often overcoming tremendous obstacles and barriers. They are involved in their schools and their communities, all the while here in Oregon. They are not responsible for how or when they came here. They did not make those decisions. Those decisions were made for them, as they were for us when we were children, by our parents. They are not responsible. They have proven they are good college-ready students. They are good Oregonians. Let's give them a chance at a college education. Now, you know, this issue about who's responsible, who's not. There's two things that have happened recently. Maybe you should be aware of this. This is like the avocados and bananas. The Statesman Journal, and I don't know how I missed this, did an editorial in Saturday or Sunday that talked about how the president has just advanced individuals with green cards who serve in our military but are unable to become citizens because the long wait has said, you're in our military serving our country, you're citizens. You're citizens. Another thing happened recently to a young man named Jacob Johnston in this state who went down to Mexico for a vacation. He's 19 years old, and when he came back, he got into trouble. Because you see, his parents, when he was born, they lived in the state of Washington, but because Bellingham was a little further away than the hospital in British Columbia, they went and they had him up there in British Columbia. That's where he was delivered. But they never took care of matters up there. This guy, all his life, has been in this state and this country, and I know that you might say this is an extreme case. Well, he unfortunately goes down to Mexico on vacation. He comes back. He spent, I think, somewhere 15 to 18 days in jail. Finally, Congresswoman Healey has got it cleared up, and he's now back here. Graduate of one of our high schools here and everything else. So, but it points out something. This young man's, the situation with his parents, they made that decision. He's having to live with it. And I don't want to badmouth children's parents. We all adore our parents. Feel very close to them. But I got to tell you, and I said this in the Senate floor when I closed on this piece of legislation, I am a politician, and I worry day and night about Peter, Sean, and Adam. Peter's 20 years old, Sean is 17, and Adam's 19. And what I worry about is something I'll do in politics in some way that will be they will have to pay for in life, will be held against them, even though it's through no fault of their own. In addition, when I was a young boy, I loved my parents. But you know, I wonder if things ever were done to me because my father was a certain type of person in Charleston, West Virginia. Wasn't a bad person. But if I wondered if people didn't judge me because I was William Vincent Courtney Jr.'s son. Because that's what we're talking about here. These kids have gone to our schools. We've required it to them. They have produced. They have learned English. They have complied by our rules and our way of life. Want to be a part of it. And they have been admitted to our public universities. And they're not asking for special treatment. They're going to pay the same tuition my son Peter's paying at Western Oregon University. One last thing. You can be not born in this state, but you can be born in this country. You come into Oregon, never heard of it before. Come into Oregon, spend 1 year here, you pay in-state tuition. I do not believe those individuals are any more Oregonian than these kids in these circumstances. So I do think Senate Bill is about fairness. I think it's a good piece of legislation. We've got good standards in it. It's paid dues. And I'm very grateful, Representative Backman, you were willing to hold a public hearing this bill. And I'm very grateful that the members of the committee were willing to allow me to come in here today and testify and to listen. So I thank each and every one of you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add on a couple of things that I omitted, which I feel are important with your indulgence. I'd like to first of all mention, as the good senator from Salem stated, that the bill passed in Texas. I believe our President George Bush, signed the bill into law, if I'm not mistaken, when it passed in Texas. With Texas, there are 19 states across this country that have this type of law. Some of them, as Senator Courtney testified, don't have the three-year requirement that we do. Some of them have one-year requirement. There is a move in Congress right now, and that's what today is all about, the National Day of Action for the many Latino youth groups that are here today. But there's a move in Congress, in the Senate, the Federal Dream Act, in the House, the Student Adjustment Act, that's dealing with this very issue right now. I'm told Orrin Hatch is attempting to repeal the concern about immigration that we'll talk about. But, you know, the writing's on the wall in other states in this country and at the federal level in this country. We have to do something to address this population that's here. Our legislative council has reviewed Senate Bill 10 very carefully because you may hear some folks say that that this bill is not in compliance with federal immigration law. Our own legislative council issued an opinion that said very clearly that the Senate Bill 10 is in compliance. And finally, you know, as Senator Courtney was testifying, I glanced over to his page to sort of cheat, and I saw Oregon Revised Statute 339.020. You know what the title of that is? The title of 339.020 is duty to send children to school. A duty to send children to school. And I looked at that and I thought, wow, that's amazing. Because whether you are picking cherries in Hood River, or you're canning raspberries in Woodburn, or you're taking pears off of trees in Medford, you have a duty, regardless of who you are, to send your children to school. So I'm just struck by that disconnect between the K through 12 policy and the higher education policy. And with that, I appreciate the indulgence.
Thank you very much.
Are there any questions?
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for clarification, Representative Dalto and Senator Courtney, on the written materials it said four states have similar laws, and I think I heard you say 19. I'm unclear here.
Chair Backman, Vice Chair Hobson, Representative Dalto, I think we know that Texas and California have it. I believe there's two more. We know, though, that in addition to that, many of these others are considering. So I don't think, really, I don't think it's... There are not 19 states that have this law. I know for a fact Texas and California have it. I believe there's two more than that. I'll leave it that way. I do believe that there's at least another 15 to 20 that are seriously looking. I think that's the accurate way to say it. A bit, Representative, I didn't mean to upset you. But so when I heard that, I sort of went like that. Billy. So I think that's the accurate statement in terms of our research, Chair Backman, Vice Chair Hobson.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, 19 states should have it if I misspoke. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Folks, as you can see, we have a good crowd, and we also have a tough week in that we are to finish House bills this week. And so what we're doing is we want to give the sides equal representation, and we're going to put a stopwatch on both sides. We'll allow 20 minutes for the pro side, and we'll allow 20 minutes for the opposition side. We'll keep the time, and we'll remind you as we move how much time there is left. So with that, we're on the pro side, those advocates who want Senate Bill 10 to be passed, and we'll call up Grattan Cairns and David McDonald, please.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Dalto.
I see maybe five people on the pro side.
Okay.
So I just ask them to keep their comments to 4 minutes so that everybody has equal time to speak, if you desire to do so.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, Grattan Cairns, Director of Government Relations for the Oregon University System. You have my statement before you. Let me hit some of the high spots. I am appearing today in support of Senate Bill 10 as amended for the following reasons. SB 10 is the subject of advocacy, both pro and con, and that advocacy is growing in intensity. The OUS is not a direct participant in that debate, but the public university system is an object of that debate. And in examining the arguments for and against Senate Bill 10, the OUS began from its own perspective. The needs of Oregon students who are academically qualified and financially able to attend an OUS campus. Thus, in balancing the values in contention over Senate Bill 10 or any other measure affecting enrollment, the OUS considers the interests of the learner first and if those interests cannot be overcome by values of a higher order, we will side with the student. And that is the case in this evaluation. We believe that the number of individuals who, students who will be advantaged by this measure is small. Mr. McDonald will address that issue. The purpose of Senate Bill 10 is consistent with the mission of the university system to engage every academically prepared and financially able Oregon high school graduate. While passage of this bill will still leave considerable financial hurdles in the way of any student who would meet all of the criteria of the amended bill, the bill does allow the OUS to evaluate these students based on their academic merit. I say that because any student who would qualify if Senate Bill 10 becomes law would still be unable to secure either state or federal grants or student loans and would have to self-finance their own education. In making the decision on the admission of a student who applies to an OUS campus under the criteria set out in ANJO's bill, the academic status of the student is separated from the residency status created by the transgressions of his or her parents or guardian when the student, as a minor child, began residency in the state of Oregon. We, under Senate Bill 10, would put those both aside. But directly, the measure would prevent the residency irregularities engaged in by her or his parents from being visited upon the child, and allows the student to correct mistakes made on their behalf in the past while pursuing a self-financed post-secondary education. And it's for that reason that we did support the amendment to Senate Bill 10 made in the Senate, because it strengthened the bill by requiring students who have now reached adulthood to accept their adult responsibility to harmonize their residency status while pursuing educational advancement. With me is Mr. David McDonald, Director of Enrollment Services, the Office of Academic Affairs of the OUS, who's conducted some research relative to the potential impact of the bill. And when he's done, we'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Backlund, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dave McDonald, Director of Enrollment and Student Services in the OUS Chancellor's Office. I was charged with determining the scope of the students who would be affected by this bill. And I must start out by saying this was a very difficult task because, quite honestly, we've never collected this data in the past, nor have other states with any accuracy. So I went to a logical approach was defining the range, knowing that somewhere between the high and the low end, the real number should reside. The range was start on the bottom end by looking at, for the past 3 years, the number of students who were in OUS, that's undergraduates, who graduated from an Oregon high school but were not U.S. citizens. Okay, this range does not count or determine whether or not they were there for 3 years, as Senate Bill 10 stipulates. Simply, did they graduate from an Oregon high school and were they not a U.S. citizen? That number over the past 3 years averages to 17. The range is 20, 20, and 11. So 17 was what their 3-year average was. The upper end is much more difficult to calculate. It's again the difficulty in determining the number of students is largely driven by the fact that a lot of these students don't walk around and register, that they do not have documentation, and they oftentimes just choose not to go to school. So it's a very difficult population to accurately count. I went to national literature, looked at the Census Bureau data, which indicated that we had 10% of our population was considered foreign-born. Foreign-born does include individuals who are here legally and have migrated. They would include my mother, who was born in Japan, but became a U.S. citizen in the 60s. Nonetheless, foreign-born is the best category the U.S. Census has in this category. I then looked at that and said, well, for Oregon, we had 22,000 high school completers in class of 2001, so we know the number of students who graduated. Assuming 10% applies to them, which in reality may be a bit high, but again, assuming 10% applies to them, that gives us about 2,200 students. Looking at our own studies in terms of how many high school seniors who graduated in class of 2001 went to OUS, we found that 25% or 1 in 4 went directly to OUS upon completion of their senior year in an Oregon high school. 25% of that puts it about 550. That's the upper end. The reality of it is the upper end should be diminished even further, but because we didn't have accurate data, I couldn't do it. But let me tell you that professionally, I believe the number should be between 25 and 50% below that, simply because when we look at enrollment patterns of students by economic background, low-income students typically go to community college if they go to post-secondary at all. Students whose parents do not have college educations are less likely to go to college at all. So you factor in those attributes, and you know the number is actually below 550. But it's very difficult, if not impossible, to peg a number exactly. The ballpark I would give is between 250 and 300 as a best guess estimate based on the hard numbers that we do have.
Mr. Chairman, in conclusion then, let me say while there is a rising level of passion both for and against the measure, looking at it dispassionately from the system's perspective and trying to find finding a low of 17 and then looking at some multiplier of that in any given year, as an addition to the 59,000 Oregon residents who are already enrolled in our university system, we're not talking about marginally much of an impact, and quite frankly, this would primarily be students who are not attending now and whose tuition paid would be a marginal addition to the revenues of the campus that they were admitted. So you deal with that passion, looking at it dispassionately and looking at it analytically. We believe that the decision should be on the part of the learner, given the fact there is no evidence to the contrary that would overweigh the admission of someone who had been a resident of Oregon, attended secondary school for 3 years, was academically qualified to be admitted, and was financially able to finance their own post-secondary education, and thus would support the measure.
Okay. Yes, Representative Farr.
Thank you. I'm not sure if either of you will be able to answer this question, but it's a question that I've been asked quite often, and I've not really found a good answer to it yet. Senator Courtney testified that it's around $1,400 per term for tuition at Oregon universities. To what extent do we subsidize the education for an in-state student?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Farr, the state support per student is declining with each month, but it is now, if you take the amount that goes to the instruction budget divided by the Oregonians who qualify for that support, is around $5,000 and falling.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions, if you wouldn't mind, please. Is there a foreign student tuition, and if so, what is it?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hobson, if a person is not a resident of Oregon, that is to say they come here with the intention of attending one of our institutions on a student visa, would pay out-of-state tuition. It's the same. It depends. It's around $13,000 to $14,000 a year based on the campus of attendance.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My second question, with the declining support for higher ed, and the discussion that there might possibly be caps put on enrollment numbers, would that then provide a situation where some potential Oregon students were displaced?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hobson, that is exactly the question which the university system addressed itself. First, the board has rejected the idea of caps, and we will not cap enrollment by numerical, mechanical, or other predetermined method. The State Board has said that there will be an enrollment management practice followed by each campus so that for each student who has state support and is admitted, will be admitted, and that state support will be used for them, and then the campuses will be free to admit as many others on the margin, not marginal students, but they're admitted on the margin, financed by their tuition alone. So there are no caps. But that is a question which is raised, and that's why Mr. McDonald and I have examined this measure very carefully. Remember what I said in my testimony. We came down on the side of the learner relative to this bill because the interest of that learner who was here, no fault of their own, of their residency status, because we find at the low 17 out of 59,000. We consider that to be de minimis. On the high side, it is some multiple of 17. It could be 100 or 150, or maybe even 200 out of 59,000. larger, but still de minimis when considered in that aggregate. Is there a point at which you would find the break-even point between someone coming in whose status was undocumented versus someone who was an Oregon citizen? Yes, but given the magnitude of the numbers, we think it'd be relatively impossible to discern that going forward. We just don't think it's likely. And that's why we did support the amendment which was inserted in this bill in Senate Bill 10, which requires the learner, now as an adult, to swear or affirm on their application to any of the 7 campuses of the Oregon University System that it is their sworn intention to seek to regularize their residency status, including seeking citizenship. And we think that is an adult responsibility we ought to ask of that person and would obviate the question of their status and their ability to receive that in-state tuition. So, yes, we did examine that very carefully, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hobson, and that's why we did come down the side of learner, because we believe while it is, there are some, they are de minimis relative to the aggregate of our enrollment.
Thank you.
Representative Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A few questions. Mr. Kern, the first question. What is? Do you have any indication of what the rate is for Mr. McDonald as well, what the rate is for students that graduate from an Oregon high school that go on to a college of any sort?
Chair Backlund, Representative Dalto, the best data that we have indicates that from the class of 2001, approximately 70% of the students who graduated from that class pursued post-secondary education at least someplace in the United States. Now, it includes out-of-state students, community college, students at private colleges, as well as OUS.
I'm going to ask you a difficult question, Mr. McDonald. Could you surmise, and you probably don't have data on this, but could you surmise what percentage of students would go on from high school to college if there were a break, say a break of 5 years or maybe 10 years between their graduation of high school and their matriculation in a college of any sort?
Chair Backlund, Representative Dalto, I cannot give you accurate data, but I will tell you what the research indicates is that with every 3-year block in time that a student is away from college or away from school, there is a precipitous drop in enrollment in post-secondary education. That doesn't totally preclude future education down the road, but it does greatly diminish that.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. Mr. Chair, further question?
Mm-hmm. Follow-up?
A question to Mr. Kearns. It seems to me that your statement about our declining state resources for our higher education system, by the way, that statement resonated with me, and it seems to me that it's not as easy as maybe I'd like it to be to take the in-state tuition and the out-of-state tuition and subtract the in-state tuition from the out-of-state tuition and say, geez, that difference is the state subsidy. It seems to me that it's not that easy. Right? And the reason why it's not that easy is because I've seen slides that show that we have a percentage of state support for our higher education system that's in, I don't know, 20-30% range. Is that what it is? The amount of dollars that the state allocates to the higher education system? Maybe you can speak to that for me.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dalto, yes, the in terms of the aggregate OUS biennial budget, state resources represent less than 30% of those dollars. But if you were to take in our aggregate budget and pull out the instruction budget, what we call education in general and higher ed speak, the instruction budget would be, in the coming biennium, probably less than 50%. We will require the student to finance a little bit more than 50%, but it's close to even as far as the cost of the education. However, there isn't a simple mathematical formula could use for those two contributions to what out-of-state tuition is, because that's a revenue raiser for each campus who enrolls an out-of-state student. So for out-of-state students, those people represent a revenue resource for the campus, and so it isn't just the difference. The difference would be between the cost of instruction, the student's share, the state's share, and the difference between what the student contributed and what the state contributed. That would be the comparison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Breton, if you know, how long after qualifying for in-state tuition does a student have to become legal?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Scott, the bill hasn't passed and we haven't begun to write an administrative rule. So we would believe that it ought to be demonstrated progress while the student is enrolled as a student and that they make a good faith effort to obtain that. But we haven't written the rule because you haven't passed the bill. Follow up?
So what's your guess?
Mr. Chairman, I've spoken to the general counsel for the Oregon University System, and it is his intention to provide to the board a rule which requires that the student to make demonstrable progress. That does not mean, Mr. Chairman and Representative Scott, that in each and every case a person will have to harmonize or regularize their status during that term. And we think that we'd have a hard time, Mr. Chairman, Representative Scott, making that a qualification for receipt of the diploma if they are otherwise academically qualified to receive it.
Follow up? Is it reasonable to believe that it would take something less than 4 years to obtain that legal status?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Scott, I'm not competent to tell you what the timeline is for someone seeking that status. There may be others who can inform you of that, but the average time degree for the university students stay is a little above 5 years now. So within that time, yes, it would seem intuitively that ought to be the case, but I can't state it definitively because I'm not prepared to. Not competent to do that.
Chair Backlund, Representative Scott, if I may. INS rules are rather much in a flux right now in terms of how they're interpreting and timelines and everything about that. I know from personal experience in that I'm in the process of adopting a girl from Korea, and everything we think is going to happen is delayed inevitably either by staffing cuts or additional regulations or additional scrutiny. So at this point in time, it is not possible to give you any measure of how long it would take INS to regularize an individual's application either for permanent residency status or citizenship, because it is incredibly variable at the current time.
Mr. Chairman, let me also say to Representative Scott, we meant it very sincerely. We believe there is an adult responsibility which will be visited upon these adults who have reached their adulthood in Oregon, even though they came here as undocumented, and we think that adult responsibility is serious. We would ask them to swear or affirm that indeed they intended to pursue that and it becomes part of their permanent student record, and it would be the intention of the OUS that they make demonstrable progress, and we would hope that they would in fact harmonize their status.
Okay, excuse me, Representative, I think probably our time is getting away and we have three people signed up who have yet to testify. Otherwise, we might ask you some more questions, but thank you very much. Dr. Trevino, Brenda Cifuentes, and Abel Carbajal, please. And how much time, Jim?
I turn the clock off during the question.
Okay. So we're okay, and what do we have?
We have only used up 7 minutes so far.
Okay. We've used up seven? Okay. So I've got 13.
During questioning.
Yeah, we have 13 to go.
Yep.
Oh, okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 10.
Oh, excuse me, could you give us for the record your name?
Yes. My name is Abel Carbajal, and I'm the chair of Latinos Unidos Siempre Youth Organization based out of Salem, Oregon. I'm here today in favor to advocate a Senate Bill 10 and to say that this bill has been long awaited. It is important because it will give the opportunity to all young people to obtain an equal education and not to be discriminated against because of their legal status. Every year there are thousands of immigrants student graduating high school with honors and as valedictorians that have dreams and aspirations of becoming contributors to their communities. They find their dreams to be shattered when it comes down to applying for college, and find that not only are they not eligible for financial aid, but on top of that, they need to pay out-of-state tuition. This makes it impossible for our future attorneys, doctors, architects, engineers to achieve their dreams and to become productive citizens of their community. It is not fair that our children pay the price for decisions made by their parents where the children had no input. These children and youth eat, sleep, and dream America. Therefore, they are Americans and deserve the same right as everyone else. This is the country that gave them self-identity, beliefs, dreams, and aspirations. Today, I'm here to urge you to vote in favor of Senate Bill 10. And with that, I also want to add that we understand that we're fighting, competing against time. And I'd like to extend an invitation to all the students that came, traveled from afar, to come and make it today. If they could please stand up to show support, those of them who are in support of Senate Bill 10, if they could please stand up to show. Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Wait.
Please. Good afternoon. Honorable and distinguished members of this committee, I thank you for the opportunity to speak before you. My name is David Trevino. I'm a professor at Western Oregon University, where I have been for 7 years. Prior to that, I was at Eastern Oregon University, the other side of the state, which is another country almost. I am here in support of Senate Bill 10. As we speak about this bill impacting on immigrants, as you just saw, and as we all know, the majority of those immigrants are Hispanic. Nowhere does it say that this is for the Hispanics. However, I know that you are aware of that. If you know your constituents, the majority of your constituents across the state, by and large, are Hispanic. They're Spanish-speaking people. So while it doesn't say that this bill is for Hispanics, we know it is, deep in our hearts. I have been a professor for 10 years here in Oregon. I was at Eastern 3 years, and I have been at Western for 7 years. And in those 10 years, I can assure you, ladies and gentlemen, that I have not had 10 students who were Spanish-speaking students. Not 10. Right now, here at Western, I have one student who is Hispanic. He was in the National Guard. He had been there. His parents are from Mexico. He joined the National Guard so that he could eventually go to college. He hadn't been in college 3 months when he was drafted to Iraq. That's the kind of immigrant we're talking about right now. The one that has the dream to go to school and give his life for our country, but cannot attend a university without being had to pay sanctions. I submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, that it is a heck of a lot more expensive to not educate our students, our citizens, than it is to educate them. It is much, much more expensive. You're looking at a Mexican woman. I'm American. I'm a U.S.-born American. So are my parents. However, right now, I would not be able to go to school. You see, my parents, who are of Mexican descent, never crossed the borders. The borders crossed them. Overnight, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, all of my relatives became American when the borders were moved. There are many like me, born, raised, U.S.-born American, very, very patriotic. Eight brothers have served in Vietnam, in Iraq, because we're very American. Paul Greenberg's Sunday column said that of the 7,331 foreign nationals in the U.S. Marines right now, 4,472 are Hispanic. That is over 60% of the Marines. But we know that the Army takes a lot more. And we know that the National Guard takes a lot more of those Hispanics. And we know that the Navy and the Air Force also takes them. One of the first Americans to die in Iraq was Lance Corporal Jose Gutierrez, a national. He was in the U.S. Marines, a national of Guatemala. And guess what, ladies and gentlemen? He was not a citizen. Now he is. The dead Jose Gutierrez, who served for our country without an education, is now a citizen. The threat that these young people may pose to some of you or some of our population by going to school and getting a higher education is no big threat. Pardon me, I normally do not get nervous, my voice does not get shaky, but this is a very, very critical issue. It's something that I feel very passionately about education and about our Spanish-speaking people that should have an education. These young people going to college do not represent a threat. They don't pose any problems to our culture, nor to our heritage, nor to our language, and certainly not to our flag and our country, because they are readily serving our country and dying. Can't we give them a chance for an education? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Backlund, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brenda Cifuentes, and I'm the co-chair of the Oregon Students of Color Coalition. I'm also a student at the University of Oregon and a graduate of Ontario High School in Ontario, Oregon. The Oregon Students of Color Coalition supports Senate Bill 10 for all the reasons you've heard this afternoon. Senate Bill 10 has broad support from educators, students, child activists, community organizations, family and child therapists. We have collected formal statements of support from Oregonians around the state who want their voices to be heard this afternoon. But I know that you will also hear from those that oppose Senate Bill 10. I would now like to take a few minutes to address their arguments. Opponents of this bill say that this will cost taxpayers money and displace Oregon college students. As you have heard from the Oregon University system, neither of these claims are true. The university system has testified that it can accommodate the added enrollment without extra cost to the taxpayers and without displacing other qualified students. It is important to recognize these students and their families do contribute significantly to our economy. A recent study proved that immigrant workers and their families contribute more to Oregon's economy than they receive in state services. Further, the Supreme Court has ruled unequivocally that students affected by Senate Bill 10 should be eligible for public education through high school. It makes no sense to continue our investment in these students after they graduate. It is unfair and unwise to encourage students to excel in our K-12 schools only to prevent them from the very goal of which education has prepared them for. Opponents of this bill will also tell you it encourages undocumented immigrants to come to our state. Again, there are multiple problems with this claim. First, it's overly simplistic to believe that people would come to our state solely for the in-state tuition rate, especially considering they would require to attend an Oregon high school for 3 years beforehand and prove their intention in becoming permanent residents. Second, if people were motivated to immigrate based on the availability of in-state tuition for undocumented students, why would they choose Oregon over California, Texas, Utah, or New York, where this benefit is already available? Opponents of Senate Bill 10 will contend that this bill is in conflict with federal law. It is not. Senate Bill 10 is modeled from legislation in California that has not yet resulted in legal challenges and that has been recommended by other states' attorneys general. When similar legislation was passed in Utah, it was originally intended to take hold only after expected challenges in federal law. However, with the state attorney general considered the issue, he ruled that the Utah state law could go in effect right away because it did not conflict with federal regulations. Finally, opponents that assert that Senate Bill 10 rewards illegal actions. On the contrary, this bill rewards hard work and dedication of young people who have overcome significant barriers to succeed in high school. These students cannot be held responsible for the decisions they did not make in situations that are out of their control. They deserve the same educational opportunities as their peers. Education has the power to change lives, and for young people who would be helped by Senate Bill 10, that power now rests in your hands. On behalf of the Oregon Students of Color Coalition in partnership with the Oregon Student Association, I hope you consider the benefits that this legislation represents for students and our state. Thank you.
Representative Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Abel. Abel, you work with a lot of Latino students. Did you hear the testimony that Gretton Kearns gave when I started to ask questions about what percentage of students drop off? They go longer and longer out of graduating from high school. And the point that I was trying to make is, if you extend the time between graduation from high school and matriculation for a university, you lose most of the people that should be going on. That was the point that I was trying to make. And I just wanted to know, based on your experience and having worked with folks, I know there's some question about how long it takes to get legal status or citizenship or those, and I don't have the answers, and I don't know if you do either, but what is your sense of those folks? To the people who would argue, let those students get legal status first, apply, and then go to college, what would happen?
Well, I myself don't have the correct figures to tell you, but based on my experience in working with youth, and especially Latino youth in this case, I found that as time goes by of not graduating high school and not enrolling in a university or college right thereafter, youth tend to lose hope. Their aspirations are shattered, like I mentioned, and also life goes on. Life is not going to wait. They get themselves into debts. They have to work. They get married, have a family, and life goes on. So yes, it is. It's in the legal process. I work with a lot of youth, like I mentioned. The legal process for immigration is a long, lengthy process. Long waiting periods that we really can't afford as a community, as a state, and for the economy, we can't afford to wait for this youth to gain legal residency. In return, we should allow Senate Bill 10 to pass. Vote yes on Senate Bill 10, and this will make it for the time they're in school getting educated, by the time they're done, by the time they receive their bachelor's, their master's, their PhD degrees, then that's the time that they're going to become, hopefully by then, the immigration process and the waiting period is going to end, come to an end, gaining a residency and bringing more to the economy as a productive citizen.
Mr. Chair, one final question.
Yes, follow up.
Thank you. What happens to the kids that don't go to college, that are waiting, and have graduated high school, they've fulfilled all the requirements of Senate Bill 10, but they can't go because they can't afford to if they don't get the in-state tuition? What happens to those students? And by the way, if they do not have legal status, are they deported? Have you ever heard of a student that's gone to high school and gotten a high school degree that's gotten deported?
Well, I personally couldn't. Well, a lot of things happen, and
I would like to pass that. A student graduated 2 years before my class and ended up getting deported with the Oregon High School diploma.
But I guess my point is, what happens to those kids if they don't? If they're here, they get to working, like you say, life goes on, life takes over, life gets in the way. What do they do? I think you already made my point.
Thank you. Okay.
Oh, by the way, Abel, are there other students in the overflow room?
Yes, I also wanted to mention that there is an overflow room full of students in support of Senate Bill 10.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Farr?
By way of answer from Representative Dalto, I was required to live in the United States for 6 years before I could apply for citizenship. But I'm not sure if the 6 year period is still the same.
Okay. Jim, what's our time situation?
We have about a minute, 20 seconds for the proponents.
Okay.
Do we have any fast talkers?
We have three signed up here. I don't know about the 20 minute 20 seconds, but we have Brenda Hidalgo, Margarita Vasquez, and Roberto. And I can't read the last name. I'm sorry, Roberto. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We're not giving them much time. We're sorry we don't have more time, but a minute and 20 is better than nothing, I guess.
I'm Margarita Vasquez. I'm the homeschool contact for Woodland High School. Unfortunately, our principal, Laura Lanka, who has been working along Senator Courtney for this bill, is not able to be here due to her health. I am really in favor of this bill. Part of the reason I've been working for 12 years at Woodburn High School. I have three children and myself who graduated from Woodburn High School, and I know the opportunities that are out there for our children. I, as homeschool contact, take these children, these students, as my own children. I see them start out as ninth graders. Even before that, I see them at kindergarten level and first grade level. Because I work for the migrant program, I am in charge of recruiting these families to the Woodburn area, and I live in Woodburn, have lived in Woodburn for almost 20 years. I feel the frustration the parents have for their children not attending colleges, universities. These parents want the best for their children. They're willing to take bank loans. They're willing to do two jobs. They're willing to do anything for their children to be professionals and return to our economy what they have been given, because public schools, as kinders through high school, these parents are threatened or to be fined if their children are not in school. So I feel that we need to give them, open the doors beyond high school and allow them to become professionals, because sooner or later they will be able to be legalized here. Some of these students that we're talking about are in process of legalization. It's just time that is taking them to get their final residency. I had a case one year where part of my job is to help them with scholarships and just filling out admission forms. I had a case where this child was given a scholarship for sports. He was a good athlete. He had opportunity to go to college in Southern Oregon, because it was the end of June and May. He was not going to get his final residency until November. Well, this child was treated as an international student. He was going to have to pay three times tuition than our regular students. The scholarship did not pay, was not going to pay enough. He was willing to work, but that was not going to be enough for him. So he had to wait one whole year before he went to that college. He's in college right now. I am really glad that he's in college and he was able to come back, because I know some of our students don't come back. And so I am here to favor this bill and in support.
Okay. Well, our time is up, and we thank you very much for those who testified and those of you in the audience. With that, we'll move to the opposition side. I see Senator George is here. Come up, please, and we'll see what you have to say, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, my name is State Senator Gary George, representing District 12. And if you'll check the vote record, you'll see that I was one of the no votes on this bill. And there's a reason for it. Now, I want to share with you something that happened a few years ago when I was on the Senate Education Committee, and we had a gentleman walk in who said something that was probably one of the most powerful things ever said in this building. And he said, "You have a choice between the 4-H and the FFA and the Bloods and the Crips." But that's not the issue here today. We're not talking about whether we want Hispanic children or Chinese children or any other immigrant into this country to succeed. We all want that. We want that very much. So we're not talking about that issue. What we are talking about is whether or not we are still a nation of law. Now, if you guys will go with me to the bill, Section 2, Line 5, says a student who is not a citizen of the United States or who is not a legal resident alien shall be considered to be a resident of the United States. Now, you saw the analysis that was prepared for us by legislative council. A simple reading of that, when you look at Section 505 of the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigration Responsibility Act of 96, is that this is clearly what was being talked about right there. But yet we came to the conclusion, somehow, by fitting words, that it wasn't. We go down again to line 27 and 28 of item number 3, and it says, student who meets the requirements of Section 2 of this section, but who is not a citizen of the United States, who is not a legal resident of the legal residence, shall be considered a resident of the states for the purpose of determining tuition and fees and state tuition for higher education. Those are just amazing statements. But what we're doing is we're taking somebody who has violated the law to be here and stating that they're not in violation of law. I'm sorry, there are ways and provisions to become a legal citizen. I honestly believe that this will be challenged. I mean, if I could, I would myself, with some tuition issues suggesting, if I'm out from out of state, that in fact the protection under the Code of the United States would indicate that every citizen must be treated fairly, that is a legal resident. This bill deals with calling someone who is here illegally to be legal. Now, I can tell you, as a person who employs, that if I hire someone knowing that they're illegal, there are legal requirements and prosecution potential for me to do that. Yet here today, we're declaring that someone who is illegal shall be the consideration of tuition be considered legal. I think it's a major step in the wrong direction. I hope you will vote no on the bill. Thank you.
Representative Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator George, thank you for taking the time to testify on Senate Bill 10. How would you respond then to the federal requirements that we educate all kids K through 12, regardless of what their background is?
Well, yeah, when they send the money for that, I would say that would be a great thing, but we don't seem to have them do that. And it is a case where I think because of 9/11, we will be scrutinizing our borders more. We will be checking to make sure that everyone that was here is here legally. I can assure you that if I went to another country and I was not in that country legally, that very strict, swift punishment would occur. That's an interesting debate, and this is a debate I think that will continue for a couple of years. But what we're doing, we're taking something that we know, because we're stating in the bill that we recognize that they're here illegally, and we're stating that they're now here legally. Well, so it's a debate that needs to continue.
Follow up?
And so, Senator, what would you do with the students that are in our K through 12 system that don't have legal status? What would you have the state do? Would you have them stop educating those children?
No, I would not obviously do that. And the issue is that, and this thing must be resolved. And it's too bad that we couldn't have dealt with that, with the fact of orderly and progressive immigration law. If you will remember, I don't think you were here at that time. In 99, I had hearings on H-2A, I think was the process. It was being promoted by Senator Wyden and Senator Schmidt, federal level. And it would have set up, again, an orderly process for immigration, rather than in opening up the door and then providing what I believe is an incentive for illegal activity for people to come to the United States for benefits. I think it just sends a really bad message. It's a debate that needs to occur. But this is going at the debate in reverse. This is saying we're going to declare the illegal to be legal. But in the meantime, until that is resolved, obviously we're going to educate those children. It's to our benefit. So we're going to have to address the major issue.
Representative Hawken?
Just because we're obviously creating a record here, I want to make sure that I understand your point clearly. I don't see in the language of this bill where it says that we're treating a person who is here illegally as somebody who is here legally. It says, of course, we're going to consider them a resident for purposes of determining tuition.
Right.
But I don't see where it says anywhere in this bill that we are considering them to be here legally.
In the process, we're doing that in essence, is what my point was, is that in fact we're treating them as if they were a resident legal, even though the bill says that we recognize that they're not legal. And that was my point. So I thank you for the record.
Thank you, Senator. We'll call up three at a time, if we may. Jim Ludwig, Elizabeth Van Staveren, and Bill Van Rye. And as a reminder, our clock will start when you folks start.
Representative Backlund, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Ludwig. I reside at 7500 Southwest Leibold Road in McMinnville. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. There was talk earlier about the number of states that have approved such legislation such as this, and in fact, there's four states that have approved this. There's two that have turned it down. The most recent attempt to pass in-state tuition for illegal aliens was turned down by the state of Washington and turned down by the state of Virginia. The Virginia Attorney General stated that this would violate federal law. America is a nation of laws. The rule of law is one of the most important components of our way of life. Most Americans strongly support the concept that everybody in this country, from the President of the United States on down to the newest citizen, must obey the law. And we put our trust in every branch of government at every level to enforce laws equally and fully, not to pick and choose which ones they like, not to pick and choose which ones are politically correct and ignore the ones they don't. If you pass Senate Bill 10, you'll violate that trust. Giving in-state tuition to illegal aliens under any circumstances is a terrible idea. To do so in the climate of what we are supposed to believe is a fiscal crisis is completely illogical. I've cut out just a couple of headlines, and I mean I could have had a lot more. Budget gap staggers capital. Schools facing a deepening crisis. My local school district, McMinnville, they're debating how many days they're going to cut, how many programs they're going to cut. These are children of American citizens. We're cutting programs for them. And here we're in the Senate, or not in the Senate, we're debating a Senate bill that gives in-state tuition for illegal aliens. Something is clearly amiss. The seven-campus university system had approximately $77 million cut out of its last budget. And what I've read is the governor may propose another $90 million cut. Proposed tuition hikes could run in the double digits. And contrary to what you heard from the representative from the university system, the chancellor suggests that they may turn away as many as 12,000 prospective students because of these budget crutches. 12,000, taking slots from American citizens and legal immigrants and giving them to illegal immigrants makes absolutely no sense. The Oregon Fiscal Office estimates the cost difference between in-state and out-of-state tuition is about $10,000 to $11,000 per year. In January of this year, the INS issued what they felt was the estimation of the number of illegal aliens in the state of Oregon in the year 2000. They estimated in the year 2000 there was about 90,000 illegal immigrants in this state. That marked a 172% increase over the previous 4 years. So obviously, we're well over 100,000 illegal aliens. If only 1% of those illegal aliens take part in this program, it will cost the state up to $10 million a year in lost revenue. Revenue that's either going to have to be deducted from the university system or increase taxes to its citizens. You heard a lot of talk today about the fact that not many students would take advantage of this. In fact, you heard a representative of Oregon Students of Color Coalition saying only a few people take advantage of it. Well, this is a flyer they passed out on the Senate side. And let me read it. Problem. Every year in the U.S., tens of thousands of graduating students are forced to discontinue their education because their immigration status makes them ineligible for in-state tuition. Tens of thousands. The interesting thing is, when this was in front of California, Bustamante Cruz debated Ward Conley on CNN. And he said, there's only about 200 people in the state of California who take advantage of this. Only 200. Not much money. Less than a year later, the same group that pushed this bill on California and set up an 800 number, a website, their goal is 12,000. 12,000! That would cost the state of California $120 million a year. Small wonder California's $35 billion in the red. In 1996, Congress passed the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act. As part of that act, they inserted Section 505 as a poison pill. The poison pill was designed to dissuade states from giving in-state tuition for illegal aliens. Basically, the pill was, if you're going to give in-state tuition for illegal aliens, you've got to give it to everybody, no matter whether they're from California, Nebraska, Utah. This could cost the state millions of dollars in that category. You know, there's been a little bit of talk about the LC's ruling on Senate Bill 10. This is a copy of it, and it's in the pass-out sheet that I passed out. And this is addressed to Senator Courtney. And it addresses Section 505. And I'm going to read from what the LC had written. Midway in the the first page, the language is not clear, and there are not any court cases or federal regulations to provide interpretive guidance. As a result, a number of interpretations have been proposed. One interpretation is that a state that offers resident tuition to students who are unlawfully present would be required to offer resident tuition to all students who are citizens or legal resident aliens, including students who are not residents of this state. In other words, we'd have to give in-state tuition to everybody. Are you willing to lose that? Are you willing to take a gamble if that's going to happen? Advocates for Senate Bill 10, of course, will argue, oh, no, we found a way around it. A sneaky way. In fact, that's what Senate Bill 10 is. It's a sneaky attempt to evade the intent of Congress. It's a sneaky attempt. I don't know how you feel about people who try to sneak around your laws that you passed, but that's what this bill is. In summary, Senate Bill 10 is an affront to every American who believes in the rule of law. Senate Bill 10 is a slap in the face to every legal immigrant who comes in here and plays by the rules. Senate Bill 10 would steal slots at our university system from American citizens and legal immigrants and give them to illegal aliens. And Senate Bill 10 is a knife in the back to Oregon taxpayers. And if you pass this, it would belie anything that you ever say about a fiscal crisis, because you wouldn't pass this if it really was a fiscal crisis. Chairman Backlund, that concludes my testimony, and I'm looking for any questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Question?
Well,
thank you very much.
I have a question.
Oh, excuse me. Representative Dalton.
Thank you for Mr. Mm-hmm. Ludwig. Is my understanding of your testimony correct that you say that there are over 100,000 illegal aliens in this state that would be eligible for in-state tuition with Senate Bill 10?
Senator Backlund, Representative Dalto, if 1% of the 100,000 known illegal aliens took advantage of this, that would amount to $10 million. Think of this. 2.3% of Oregon's population is in one of the seven universities. 2.3%, about 80,000 people. So it's not incomprehensible that 1% of the illegal aliens would take advantage of this. And in fact, as I said earlier, California's going to try to recruit 12,000.
Mr. Chair,
follow up.
Sir, are you a sociologist or a social scientist that has experience in doing research on populations?
You know, Chair Backlund, Representative Dalto, I'm an American citizen.
Okay. Well, then I'd like to ask you, in your experience, how many of that 100,000, you said one, if just 1% is your testimony, then it cost us $10 million, I think was your testimony. How many of that 100,000 people do you think are even eligible or have the experience or the ability to successfully enter a university or competitively? How many people of that 100,000 do you think have an education?
Well, one of the problems is, and Senator, Representative Backlund, Representative Dalto, one of the problems is because of ORS 181.850, nobody in the state can ask who's illegal. So you never have any idea who's really illegal. So how do you determine how many people are going to do what?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth.
My name is Elizabeth Van Staveren. I live in McMinnville. Chair of the Ackland, members of the committee, the aim of Senate Bill 10 is to give in-state tuition rates to illegal immigrants. This bill is about immigration. There are a few residency and other requirements, but the bill benefits no citizen of the U.S. nor any legal resident. It applies only to persons living here illegally. Why should we sacrifice scarce education funds to help illegal immigrants when citizens and lawful residents need the spaces in Oregon colleges and the resources to maintain our colleges adequately? This bill condones, encourages, and rewards illegal immigration. It is part of a nationwide campaign to gain amnesty for illegal immigrants. Proponents include the Mexican government, foundation-funded ethnic identity groups, the leadership of the Democratic Party and profit-minded employers seeking to push wages to the lowest possible level. They have failed so far to win amnesty through the U.S. Congress and are now pursuing their goal piecemeal and in individual states. The public at large has made it clear in many polls over the years that it opposes illegal immigration. The toleration of illegal immigration cheapens the value of their citizenship, depresses their wages and working conditions, destroys job opportunities, and inflates the population. Most seriously, it disrespects the sovereignty of our nation. We should not add to the incentives to immigrate here illegally. SB 10 is an incentive and a reward for illegal immigration. It has been said that children should not suffer because of the sins of their parents. Therefore, children brought here by their illegal immigrant parents should not be considered illegal immigrants. But it is a fact of life that everyone suffers from the sins of their parents, including American citizens, and we do not expect the government to use taxpayer money to make up for this. Parents must realize that their deeds, good or bad, affect the lives of their children, and that parents are responsible for the effects on their children, who may have to pay a price for their parents' misdeeds. It has been said that 60 or so people showed up for hearings on SB 10 in the Senate, and there was no opposition. SB 10 is a bill that will hand out thousands of taxpayer dollars to certain students. When people expect to profit by thousands of dollars from a bill, it's no miracle that many show up to support the bill. It helps, too, to have a state-funded Commission on Hispanic Affairs on duty to coach and prepare lobbying groups and to keep them apprised of hearing dates well in advance. Our country suffers from overpopulation already. Those of us speaking in opposition to SB 10 love this country and want to see it become, continue to be a beacon to the world, an example of a prosperous, free republic that understands there are natural limits to growth. Current population growth is fueled nearly 90% by immigration, not by high birth rates of native citizens. We must live within environmental constraints if future generations are to enjoy what we have enjoyed. This means greatly reduced immigration and no illegal immigration. It means no to all incentives to illegal immigration, including SB 10. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Representative Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Van Staveren, is it?
Yes.
Are you a member of Oregonians for Immigration Reform?
Yes, I am.
How many in your group?
We have between 200 and 300 members.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, for the record, my name is Bill Van Rye. I'm a resident of Lincoln City and a member of Oregon's for Immigration Reform. I appreciate the opportunity to speak in opposition to SB 10, a bill more appropriate to the beginning of the 20th century, not the 21st. In prior testimony, the Oregon State University saw no higher value involved in the tuition issue other than concern for the students. I suggest to you that there is indeed a higher value. There's a very high value at stake, namely the prosperity of the state and the nation and the preservation of the environment which sustains us. Let me explain. Over the last century, the U.S. population has nearly quadrupled from 76 million to well over 290 million. According to the latest national census, Oregon grew twice as fast, that's eightfold, in that 100-year period to 3.4 million. In the decade of the 90s, it surged 20.4% compared to the national growth rate of 13.2%. Now, obviously, Oregon is an attractive state because its relative size, natural resources, and unparalleled beauty, assets that are in peril as more and more people come to stay. The U.S. Census Bureau's high-range projection of half a billion by mid-century and a billion by 2100 seems more likely now due to out-of-control immigration and the highest birth rate since 1971. Immigrants and their U.S.-born children now account for 60% of U.S. population growth. Simply put, the nation's population is exploding exponentially, primarily due to immigration. That's a fact. It may not be politically correct to say it, but the data are irrefutable. So what does all this mean? Well, it means we have a numbers problem of great magnitude that is jeopardizing both the environmental and economic health of the nation and state. Let me clarify. This is not about race, ethnicity, nice people, bad hombres, or penalizing foreigners. What this is about is a demographic invasion perpetuated by bad congressional immigration policy, incompetently administered by the INS, and worsened by poor border security, all of which threatens the opportunity for Oregonian to live a decent life and make a good living. Think about it. And I want the young people in this room to hear this. Any U.S. child born in recent years is destined to live in the same crowded conditions experienced by present-day China and India, and probably with the same socioeconomic limitations, unless we as a people take immediate measures to reduce our swelling girth.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Representative Fong?
After the
Oh, okay. Very good, Chair.
SB 10 does just the opposite. It encourages migrant families to move to the U.S. by giving them special consideration and incentives to break immigration laws. The bill is simply counterintuitive, counterproductive, and discriminatory. Anyone who is even half aware of state budget woes is going to seriously question the wisdom of waiving $50,000 in tuition fees for the benefit of an illegal immigrant wanting to attend an Oregon college for 5 years, when there are cutbacks in health care to the poor, slashing of educational budgets across the board, the closing of schools, teachers stressed with larger classrooms, fewer school days available to students, less secure highways as a result of fewer troopers, and of course the potential loss of jobs for state workers. What seems very perplexing to me, and I'm sure to a lot of others, is why there is no budgetary or financial forecast on the cost of this bill to Oregon taxpayers. How can any member of the House knowingly vote for a measure with no official price tag, especially in view of the economic climate and the open-ended exposure of SB 10? To conclude, there is no rational way, in my estimation, to justify SB 10, and I urge, when it comes to a vote, that you do vote no. For those House members compelled to give a tuition break to help others, let's draft a substitute educational bill that gives financial assistance to state veterans returning from the Afghani and Iraqi wars. These law-abiding men and women put their lives on the line for this country and have earned this kind of special consideration. I thank you for your time and allowing me to speak.
Representative Parr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a part of your testimony. Part of your testimony is stated, and I'm paraphrasing this, you say that immigrants and their children are degrading life in Oregon.
I would say that the impact of immigration and the expanding population, coupled with the rising population of all people, is, yes, degrading the quality of life.
So you're talking about me and my family.
Uh-huh. You're talking about me, too.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Parr. You're talking about me. You're talking about my family as well. We're all doing that.
Representative Dalton.
Yes, from the testimony, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 10 gives people an incentive to come here illegally and go to college. I believe you said, that's paraphrasing what you said, but I'm wondering, you know, do we get off the boat and go straight to college? Or do we go to high school? Do we go to elementary school? Do we go to middle school? And do we prepare academically to be a competitive candidate for higher education? I don't see the logic between being an immigrant coming to this country and automatically being able to go to college. I mean, you know, I went to Willamette, and I'm another one of those immigrants. My father was born in Argentina, mm-hmm. came to this country, and you know, I'm crying to God that he did, because two of the one, two, three, four, five, three of the six panelists here are from pretty much immediate immigration, have an immediate immigration background. So let me get back to my question.
Sure.
You said that Senate Bill 10 gives an incentive for folks to come here illegally and go to college. How can you say something like that when you know that you have to be prepared before you can go?
I said it encourages immigrant families to move to the U.S. by giving them special consideration and incentives to break immigration laws.
Do you think that people
to give their children an opportunity?
Hey, in Oregon, we can come up and we can get, you know, special treatment in Oregon for a college. Do you think that message gets through to folks who don't even have an education?
Well, as people course their way across borders, they go to where the best opportunity is. Oregon has a wonderful opportunity here, and especially when they recognize. Say, yes, when my child comes here, regardless of what my legal status is, my child can go to college here at low tuition rates.
Should I have stayed in New York, by the way, so as to avoid degrading the quality of life of Oregonians?
Well, we could probably say that about anybody not coming into the state, couldn't we?
I just was curious.
Yeah. See, the issue is population. And you need to understand that the population dynamic is an overload on the environment. The science is there. It's clear. People have to be balanced in relation to the ability to sustain life. The data is here. Let me give you an example. Current scientific studies show that the current ecological carrying capacity of the United States, at the most generous assessment, is 200 million people. We are over 50% of nature's lifeboat's carrying capacity in this country. I don't have that figure for Oregon. Now, this isn't just out of the blue. This is studies done by Dr. David Pimentel of Cornell University and others, other ecologists, who are trying to get this message across. When you pass a bill like SB 10, it's that incremental incentive. Bills that encourage immigration, that encourage population growth, we have to look at it in the context of what's it do to our ability to sustain our economy and our life. And that's the essence of my presentation.
Okay, we're down to about, actually, 4.5 minutes, Jim tells me. So thank you for testifying. We'll call up Doug Smith, Bob Phillips, and Peter Dane.
I don't think he said any of the different time of call set there.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Education Committee, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Bob Phillips. I'm a resident of Portland, Oregon. I'm here to speak in opposition to Senate Bill 10 for the following reasons. Illegal immigration is a crime. Everybody in the room knows that, but some will not acknowledge it. Granting resident tuition to illegal immigrants undermines our federal laws, which are aimed at providing security for all citizens and legal immigrants. Granting resident tuition to criminals is a slap in the face of legal immigrants who endured the process and the wait to be legally admitted. A reading of Senate Bill 10 shows no cost. This is absurd. It is an insult to the public, and especially to you House members who were asked to pass the bill with the assurance of the Senate that there is no cost to Oregon taxpayers. Certainly there is cost, a cost concealed by the Senate, because Senate Bill 10 will not stand on its merits if the cost is known. Now you are asked to join in the deception. In these days of reduced budgets for all state agencies, including education, it is unconscionable to grant special privileges to illegal immigrants while denying adequate funds for K through 12 schools. The example has been several examples of the shortened school year by many school districts. And of course, adequate funds for higher education as well. For these reasons, I urge you to vote no on Senate Bill 10. Thank you.
Next, please. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Representative Bachman and August members of the House Education Committee. I passed out some a paper that has all my comments on it. For the sake of brevity, I'm just going to skip through this.
Could you, for the record, indicate your name, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. My name is Peter Dane, and I live in Salem. There's several reasons why Senate Bill 10 would cause problems in a school system that is already overburdened with discipline, learning, and budget woes. First point is Senate Bill 10 would further complicate the twilight zone of illegal activity in Oregon. Our prisons are full. The police departments are understaffed. This would further lead the public down the road of twilight illegal activities. Senate Bill 10 is a contradiction of Section 505 of the 1996 Illegal Immigration Reform Act. If you know how to read, it's obvious that Senate Bill 10 contradicts the 1996 Illegal Immigration Bill. To promote Senate Bill 10 takes us down a revolutionary states' rights path. On closer examination, Senate Bill 10 promotes racial and national preferential treatment. Unbiased demographic surveys predict that over 90% of the growth of enrollment in Oregon schools will be from children of immigrants. You can look up these statistics on the U.S. Census website. Over 80% of those are Hispanic. What about the other students from 100 countries? They're being discriminated against tacitly. Third point is looking at the skyrocketing enrollment of schools in the western states by children of immigrants, it's easy to predict that the $10,000 projected college tuition discount would have a ever-increasing number of applicants. Word gets around, if you're ever a student, real fast about where the economic opportunities are. Senate Bill 10 would condone the existing high tuition rates for state colleges while not examining the skyrocketing school costs of the last few decades. You know, ideally, we should get back the way it used to be when everyone could afford to go to college. Something's really out of whack that the state teachers' union are so greedy and leave a lot of school programs in jeopardy. While education budgets have doubled in the last decade, test scores have not. Only a sophist, if you know what that means, would promote an arcane education bill like Senate Bill 10. And fifth and last, Oregon's generosity with primary and secondary education should not be a further burden with the dubious entitlements and special favors for more education. That completes my testimony. A more complete text is available on the handouts I've given you. Representative Bachman and other members of the House Education Committee, do you have any questions?
You know, gentlemen, we're out of time, and I see we have one person here who is not getting to testify, and there are others who have signed up. So this concludes the testimony for the day, except recently coming into our midst is Senator Metzger, and Senator Metzger would like to testify. So, on his bill. Okay, excuse me.
Mr. Chair, yes. Maybe we can let the gentleman state his name for the record.
Yes, that would be good.
All right. My name is Doug Smith. I live at 14th and Temecula. May I make a question, Representative Backlund? Could we get a formal fiscal impact statement on this bill?
I think we have something to that effect, and I think we could probably provide that. That'd be fine. Yeah. Okay. With that, then, thank you very much, audience. We appreciate your attentiveness and your politeness and your consideration for the testimony on both sides. With that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 10A. Oh, that's okay. Again, what was it, 238?
Yeah.
You said 388.
Written the one next on it?
Yeah. 388? Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Members will stand at ease for just a moment or two while the...
Oh, yeah. Hello. What
yes.
A few people have signed up on that.
Work session on Senate Bill 388A. Senator Metzger, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Rick Metzger from the Senate Chamber on Concealment and Deception. Welcome to be here with you today, however. I enjoyed your previous hearing, Senate District 26. And I'll be brief. I want the members to know I do have a few people, educators from my district, in the audience, should there be any questions. As I've spoken with the chairman about this bill, it has no opposition in deference to the committee. I don't want to take any more time than you would like, but certainly we are here to answer any questions. Senate Bill 388 comes to you unanimously out of the Senate. It is a bill that addresses an issue with the Oregon School Activities Association, and I will tell you off the top, in the A. Engross bill, they were wonderful to work with, and that's why we reached this compromise that everyone can support. Specifically, 388 makes it clear that the Oregon School Activities Association, in putting together rules for the possible redistricting of schools into other school district athletic and activity leagues, needs to, number one, adopt rules and have those rules adopted by the State Board of Education so that every school, any school in your district or anywhere else within the state of Oregon, faced with, which is always a very difficult situation when you're moving to another athletic league and the trepidation that causes, is to provide clarity so that everyone knows what the rules of the game are, that the goalposts don't change, and that's something that is extremely difficult, that everyone understands what the criteria are to be applied. Under Senate Bill 388, the OSAA continues to make their own rules, but it does provide a hearing process in the sense that they go to the State Board of Education to have them formally adopted. This bill arises from a situation in my district, specifically involving Hood River, although I've heard from many fellow members with different instances over the past in their own districts, in which they were moved to a different league, and found it very, very difficult to adapt to the criteria that they believe continued to move during the process of hearings. This will allow that process to go forward with clarity. Everyone will know what the rules are. The Oregon School Activities Association, in reaching this agreement on this bill, also testified in the Senate that this would provide clarity for them as well, so that everyone understood what the rules are. I think it just provides clarity to everyone in a very difficult situation. Again, there are people in the audience who can ask any questions specifically. Otherwise, I'm here to address any questions you might have. I would appreciate your support.
Senator Metzger, if you had looked to the amendment,
yes,
Section 3, that is that the heart and soul of the bill now as amended?
Yes. It means that by next June that the OSA must adopt their rules and present them for filing with the State Board of Education.
Thank you.
Yes, that essentially is the bill.
Members, I think you're well aware that the state board has designated the Oregon School Activities Association to govern high school athletics, high school band, rally squad contests, and a number of activities. And so it's very important that we have the OSAA do this on behalf of all of our high schools and all of our leagues. It's also important that I think that the essence of this bill be moved. I think it's important that we say that the rules are important, they have to be followed, and there has to be a process. And so I certainly am in support of Senate Bill 388A. So does anyone else have anything to ask of Senator Metzger?
Well, after the last hearing, I'm so shocked. You get through a lot of questions.
We're worn out.
Thank you. Thank you.
Senator, thank you very much for coming and bringing this bill to us. With that, we're in a work session. Representative Hobson, do you have a motion for us? Yes, we want to move the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 388 now, please.
Okay. Thank you very much. Senator Hobson moves the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 388. Any discussion? Oh, excuse me, Representative.
We have the first bill.
Yes.
We do.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I don't think
so. Are there amendments other than the what's in the A and Gross?
No. I was, excuse me, Representative Aki, that's a good point. I was looking at the Senate amendment to the Senate bill before I looked at the A and Gross, so I may have confused a little bit, confused the situation inadvertently.
Just wanted to do it.
Yeah, well,
so A and Gross has the -1.
I guess actually A and Gross does have the -1, so we don't need the amendment. Very good. So, Senator, Representative Hobson, we'll try it again.
I appreciate the motion.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 388 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation, please.
388 and Gross, right?
Yes.
Okay, thank you, Representative. Representative Hobson moves Senate Bill 388 A and Gross to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Jan, follow the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Excuse?
Aye.
Aye. Having received the constitution majority, Senate Bill 388 A and Gross is declared passed. Do we have a volunteer carrier?
I'd be happy to.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Representative Bakken. Representative Bakken will be the carrier. Again, thank you, Senator Metzger. Mm-hmm. Which one? How about you? I'm sorry?
Can't forget.
Okay. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 130. Gina, we're out of order, sorry. Our time is kind of getting away from us here a little bit. Thank you. Jim, did you bring us up to date here?
Yes, sir. Senate Bill 130 allows State Board of Education to adopt rules to administer the National School Lunch Program and School Breakfast Program for public and private pre-kindergarten through grade 12 schools and residential child care facilities.
Okay, thank you very much. Joyce Doherty, the Oregon Department of Education, please. Did I pronounce that name correctly?
That's right.
Oh, thank you. Good.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Joyce, Director of the Child Nutrition and Food Distribution Program. I am passing out my original statement to the Senate, but I will briefly summarize the bill. This bill is essentially a housekeeping bill suggested by legal counsel to ensure that private schools and residential child care institutions in Oregon can be, without a shadow of a doubt, officially eligible for participation in the National School Lunch Program. Currently, 52 private schools and 60 residential child care institutions participate in the National School Lunch and School Breakfast Program. Federal regulations require that sponsors, that is, participants in the National School Lunch and Breakfast programs, shall have facilities inspected for food safety by a state or local government agency responsible for food safety inspections. Local environmental health departments did not have statutory authority to inspect school food service facilities. So on May 16, 2002, the State Board of Education adopted administrative rules giving health departments that authority. However, legal counsel pointed out that officially, Oregon administrative rules for the Department of Education only apply to public schools. The purpose of this legislation, Senate Bill 130, is to clarify that the administrative rules governing fleet inspection can and do apply to private schools and to residential child care institutions. Senate Bill 130 will simply allow us to say to the federal government, the private schools and residential child care institutions that participate in the school lunch program are subject to food safety regulations as required by federal law. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Well, you've done very well. You've answered the issue very well. Thank you. Okay. Yes, Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate Bill 130 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Hobson moves Senate Bill 130 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Here, call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Excuse?
Aye.
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 Oh, thank you. Having received a constitutional majority, Senate Bill 130 is declared passed. A carrier?
I'll carry it.
Oh.
If I might.
Representative Dalton, that would be fine.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Dalton.
Okay.
I see that we have members. We have Senator Deckard here. We will go out of order and take his testimony, and it may be that we may not have much time to go further, but certainly we want to accommodate the senator. So,
Mr. Chair,
yes,
may I be excused? I'm traveling to Eugene for a budget committee meeting.
Oh, you are?
Yes.
Okay. And Senator, you're asking to testify on Senate Bill 287. Is that correct?
Yes, okay. That is correct.
Okay, we will open a public. We'll open a possible work session on Senate Bill 287. Senator Deckard, Senator, we've got Jim to bring us up to date on the staff summary.
I just noticed my phone.
Oh my gosh!
Senate Bill 287. Require school districts to create summer food service programs at public schools that have certain percentage of students eligible for free and reduced price meals. Allows waiver of requirements under specified circumstances. Allows the Department of Education to award grants to school districts for summer food service programs. Appropriates $49,000 from general fund to Department of Education for grants.
Okay, thank you. Senator Deckard.
Mr. Chair, members of the House Education Committee, thank you. First of all, I know you've had a very long day, so I will be very brief and just receive my testimony on this bill, which you're getting in front of you. This bill is a really creative solution to one of the most vexing problems we face in Oregon, and it's simply that we rank number one as the hungriest state in the nation. And this is one approach. It was one of three, although it surfaced as one of the top three that this legislature could do to really help solve this problem. Now, it doesn't in any way, and you can, by the modesty of the proposal, know that this is not going to solve the hunger problem amongst children, but it really is a positive step. It goes at what are those school districts that are now feeding children, and what are the districts in the top 15 or 20% that really have the highest number who qualify for the federally reduced lunch program? How do we get those students during the summer? This, by accessing 80% federal funds, and these are federal dollars that currently we are just turning away. Those are federal dollars that we could access and put into sandwiches into the hands of kids over the summer months, and it's a creative approach of how do we really do that. We access 80% by the $49,000 price figure. We help school districts across the state, and we decided in the Senate Education Committee not to send this to Ways and Means because it has a $49,000 price tag. I would ask this committee to consider doing, to adopt the Dash 2s and consider doing the same thing. We've been working with Representative Pinope as the co-sponsor of this bill to really take the first, and I know, Mr. Chair, you like metaphors, so I will say the first bite at the apple at addressing how do we put lunches in the hands of students in the summer months when it's really 80% or 90% of these students at some of these schools, and that's just an incredible figure, qualify for free and reduced lunch. how do we make sure that those 80 and 90% schools get that same lunch the kids do in the summer? And I think you're going to hear some really compelling testimony. I don't know if you have time today, but we heard some really incredible stories of kids that, you know, I asked the question, well, would you, in the summer months, would you be inclined to go to this, you know, it's usually community groups, and that's the only thing that we mandate in here is that you have a community meeting in these high-need districts. Would you really go out in the summer when you have all these other things to do and go and get a free lunch? And it's really incredible, but a lot of these kids that we heard from, yes, because when you're hungry, you're hungry. And that lunch is the only thing that you can count on, and when that's the case, you go and do it. So I thank you for hearing us on a really busy day, and appreciate this committee's consideration of, I think, a really important bill.
Okay, very good. Senator, we're looking at the Dash 2s. You have a task force created in the Dash 2s?
Yes, we changed this bill a little bit as it came over from the Senate. You know, it came out, very frankly, just a mandate that if you're one of these 70% or above, and we graduated as the years progressed, but if you have a high, we had it as a mandate. Obviously, folks in the school community are very appropriately so concerned about mandates, although it's a funded one, 80%. Most of the money is coming from the federal government. I would just hate to see Oregon forego federal dollars that are played into lunches for kids. And so we're trying to find, and that's what you have in front of you with the Dash 2s, is how do we creatively approach this, working with the school community, who had just some minor concerns, same goal, but minor concerns. And that's what the Dash 2s represent, is really how do you get the community together to help bring those federal dollars in. And really, in the budget situation that we're in, and we're going to get the numbers on Thursday, some of it is just keeping the programs that we do have alive and getting the federal dollars to replace state dollars that we're unfortunately yanking away from these districts. But the programs that are up and running, how do we keep those going, and how do we expand them in these really high need where you just have such a high proportion of your students are free and reduced lunch?
Mm-hmm. Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, am I right in understanding the Dash 2s? They actually put a task force in place, but it's volunteers, and there will be no costs associated with that task force?
Correct. This committee probably knows as well as anyone that there are a lot of people that are really dedicated to. I mean, that's what we found, is we have volunteers and folks who are dedicated to solving the hunger problem in Oregon. And that's why we only needed really what we thought was $49,000, partly wanted to stay out of the Ways and Means process. This is a modest proposal. But also, you have a lot of really dedicated people that are ready to do the transportation. The way that these manifest themselves is often it's a church or community group that works with that school district to go out in rural areas. It tends to be buses or other, just to drive the lunches out to one spot, and the kids congregate at that spot.
Okay, excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll call up Karen Roth, Jennifer Gibson, and Tina Kotick. Yeah. Who would like to begin?
I'll start. Thank you, okay. Chair Beckham, and thank you, members of the committee. My name is Karen Roth, and I work for Food for Lane County in Eugene. We're a private nonprofit organization that we're the food bank for the entire county. Food for Lane County has been sponsoring the Summer Food Service Program since 1997, and I've been the manager since 1999. Last summer, we had 50 sites throughout the county, served out over 105,000 hot meals to children and youth, about 3,000 a day. I've come here today on behalf of Food for Lane County in support of Senate Bill 287. Too many of our children go hungry during the summer, only to return to school in fall, malnourished and unable to concentrate and to learn. Research has shown that children who suffer from poor nutrition during the brain's most formative years score much lower on tests of arithmetic, vocabulary, reading, comprehension, and general knowledge.
Food insufficient teenagers are more likely to be suspended and from school, and children in this category are more likely to see a psychologist and to have difficulty interacting with their peers. Even moderate malnutrition can have lasting effects and compromise cognitive development and school performance. Some people say that feeding children is not our school problem. Well, I'm here today to tell you that it is their problem, it is my problem, it is your problem. As a society, it is all of our problems. When children are falling behind in classes, when children are dropping out of school in frustration, when hungry, tired, and cranky children are disrupting the class and taking the teacher's time away from other students, that is our problem because those are our children in that classroom. While our teachers and schools are committed to educating our children, the lack of adequate nutrition makes this task difficult, if not impossible. But there is hope, and that is the Summer Food Service Program. It helps ensure that children are well-fed and come to school each fall ready to learn. We know our public schools currently face overwhelming budget shortfalls. Many schools may feel that taking on the Summer Food Program is too daunting a task. I'm here today to tell you that nonprofits like Food for Lane County can partner with schools to make a difference in the cognitive and physical development of our children. It's not easy, but nothing worthwhile ever is. Lane County has 16 school districts. Food for Lane County has had a site at every summer school that we can qualify for the Summer Food Service Program. We work closely with the schools to make this happen. We hire school kitchen personnel to run our four kitchens. We borrow equipment from the schools to make sure everything is handled properly and safely. They are our partners, and we work together to ensure children remain healthy and ready to learn, and you can do the same by supporting Senate Bill 287. To paraphrase Ronna Kleinman, the chair of the Committee on Nutrition at the American Academy of Pediatrics, our children will lead us into the future, and we do not have a single child to waste. To provide each with opportunity to achieve their maximum potential, we must ensure that they receive nutritionally adequate and appropriate diets. Thank you for allowing me to speak.
Good afternoon. My name is Jennifer Gibson. And first of all, I would like to thank you for allowing me to be here and speak to you today, share my personal experience with the Summer Food Program with you. While growing up in Salt Lake City, my family and I lived in low-income housing. My mother, although she did the best she could, was not able to ensure three meals a day. We received help from the state in every aspect of living: food stamps, energy assistance, job placement for my mother, and three meals in school. While most children looked forward to school because of the social aspect, my three younger sisters and I looked forward to it because we knew that that one meal or two when we had breakfast was what we would get for that day. Summer vacation wasn't always easy. Our peers were usually going on family picnics and gorging themselves with junk food, while my sisters and I would walk up to the Catholic Church with other children from our complex and beg for sack lunches. Those sack lunches generally consisted of ham sandwiches on raisin bread and an apple. Although not the most appealing lunch in the world, that's what we got. Unfortunately, the problem with relying on help from the church was that it was only available one day a week. For the other 6 days, we had to hope that my mother had the means to provide us with the food. The worry of going hungry diminished immensely in 1992 when the school we were attending made it possible for us to receive school lunches throughout the summer months. We got to go to the school and eat our sack lunch, and we were involved in daily activities such as baseball or whatever else. The Summer Food Program has helped me in several ways. It helped my mother keep us fed year-round and gave my sisters and I the chance to see that there's always someone willing to help us. There's always someone willing to help keep us healthy and out of trouble. I would not be the person that I am today without this program. With the outcome of this program, a giant weight was lifted off of my mother's shoulders, which helped ease the tension that usually came with vacations from school. The summer program is a program I feel every community needs. Why should we take a break from feeding lower-income children throughout the summer months? Why should our children dread taking a vacation from school? I urge you all to be a proponent to this bill. Please think of those children and their right to be free from hunger.
Thank you once again for allowing me to speak.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tina Kotek. I'm the Policy Director with Children First for Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 287 today. As you've heard from Karen and Jennifer, some very compelling testimony. Hearing from providers who make the program work, hearing from someone who's benefited from the program. And as Senator Deckard has mentioned, we have a hunger problem in this state. So this is one bill. If there's any bill that you work on this session to do something about hunger in the state, this is the bill. It will make sure that programs that are running now to feed children in the summer continue to stay running, and we could expand to have more programs in some of the high-need areas in the state. Children First has made it a top priority for us this session because we know we have a hunger problem, and there's no worse part of that hunger problem than have children to be hungry during the summer months. There are thousands of children who depend on free and reduced price lunches during the school year to get a good, healthy meal. There's no reason those same children should not have access to food, those same nutritious meals during the summer. The state has an obligation to do what it can to maximize the federal program and to help those schools and community groups continue to run their programs. This bill came out of the Senate in a different format. We've been working closely with the education community to amend this bill to make it work for the schools and for the local communities. We support the changes in the bill, and essentially what they are is providing money to schools and community groups in the highest need areas where 85% or more of children are eating free and reduced price lunches, having that $49,000 go to help supplement the reimbursement they get from the federal government. When we first came up with this bill, we didn't think we'd be in the situation we are, but now with schools and the budget crisis and frankly how nonprofits are suffering, the state needs to be helping those programs stay afloat right now, and that's what the amendments to this bill do, and we support that. The bill also talks about a task force, which I will get to in a second. I think after we got the amendments from LC, we thought maybe an advisory group would be simpler. The task force sounds rather dramatic. Although it's an important problem, it seems rather cumbersome. But we support having a group look at how the program is being run because it doesn't work for all schools, so what can we do better? And in the off season, that group would get together and look at the program. So we support that, as well as the long-term goal of looking to expand more state support for schools and community groups to run the summer food program. Oregon is one of the only states in the country that doesn't contribute any state funds to helping the federal food programs work for children, and that's a problem. In terms of the task force language, we would suggest that the committee might want to amend them slightly to talk about an advisory group and maybe take off some of the more technical, formal-sounding, bureaucratic parts of the task force. What we had in mind was an advisory group of experts and folks out in the general public who run these programs, getting together, talking about solutions and making it run quickly and coming up with recommendations. The task force language in the amendment seems a little too much. But we support the intent, and maybe you want to change it to an advisory group. And finally, I just want to say that I hope that you can pass this with a recommendation, a do pass recommendation also, to rescind the referral to Ways and Means. And the reason I say that is there are a lot of bills out there right now, and they all have small price tags, but the governor has spoken about how serious the hunger problem is. You know how serious the hunger problem is. This is one concrete step, albeit a small one, but a concrete step that can help not only feed the kids this summer, but continue to feed them in summers ahead. And if you do one thing this session, I would say please don't, you know, have it go to Ways and Means and potentially sit. This needs to be taken care of now, and we hope you can move it to the floor as soon as possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Tina, did you say that? Did I hear you say that the dash two, while you support the intent, is not quite what you would have in mind?
Mr. Chair, thanks for the question. Yes, we only saw these amendments this morning, and I know Senator Deckard's office has been working hard to get them together, and we really had more of an advisory group in mind, but I think we used the language task force, which apparently comes with all kinds of extra language with it, which we didn't realize, and we were thinking something a little bit more simple. So we thought maybe an advisory group and taking out some of the sections on, the designating and all this kind of extra language. And I just want to add, while I have the opportunity, is that I think our partners in the education community, Portland Public Schools and some of the other groups, have worked really hard to come to an agreement with us about what could really work in this legislation, and I want to commend their commitment to feeding children, and that's why we think the amendments are good, except for that slight change with the advisory group.
Okay. Perhaps you can work with Jim and get the language that you'd like to see.
We'd be happy to do that. Thanks.
Good. And Jennifer, I do have one question. You mentioned junk food earlier. Do you still eat junk food?
Of course I do.
You don't need to answer that. Well, thank you very much. Patty O'Sullivan, Patty Whitney Wise, and I don't think Mickey Lansing is here, but you're representing Mickey, as I understand it. Okay. Patty O'Sullivan is representing everyone.
Okay. Good afternoon. For the record, I'm personally Patricia O'Sullivan, Portland Public Schools, but I'm also representing OSBA, COSA, and the Commission on Children and Families, because they either had to go or, you know, they said, you come up. So, at the risk of insulting Senator Deckert, I did not like the bill at all on the Senate side and testified against it. However, again, we have worked very, very hard to make it something that both the education community and the social services and food folks can all agree on. My purpose in the amendments was to have no unfunded mandate go to school districts, and the original bill had a whole bunch of mandates. Let me just give you a little bit of background about Portland Public School and sort of where we're at with the summer food program. We run a summer food program. We have five schools that are above 80% free and reduced lunch, and another five that are above 85% free and reduced lunch. So we have a large pocket of poverty in our city, as you can well imagine. We have run summer food programs. The problem with it is that in these budget crunches, our nutrition services has to be self-funding. They don't get any general fund from the school budget. They get 80% federal funds, and then I think another bill that was in front of you, they sell Coke and they do that kind of stuff, you know, that they make up the difference. So they have to pay for themselves. They don't get any appropriation from our regular budget. 2 years ago, our nutrition services lost $33,000 on our summer food program. And last summer, they lost $3,000. They made some changes and made it more efficient, and they lost $3,000. And frankly, with the budgets the way they are, we were considering cutting some of these programs. You have to have two things to make it viable. First of all, you usually have to have another activity with it. Recreational, scholastic, something for the kids to come there for. That's typical. And then you also have to have a certain amount of kids to even make it viable to bring the lunches to that site and give them to the kids, and that's about 75. Ours was at 50, and we had to move it up to 75 to make it more cost effective. Even with that, we still lost a little bit of money. So we were considering cutting some or all of the programs because of our budget constraints, which you've all read about. A good thing that this bill did, well, it's going to do a lot of good things now, but one of the good things that just bringing it to this body did was to make us take a second look inside our district at what we're going to be doing with our summer food programs. I asked the superintendent if he would talk to the nutrition director and commit to the nutrition director to at least fund them, whether the bill passed or not, for at least another summer, whether we lose $3,000 on it, and to go ahead and transfer that money over. And he's agreed to that. So that's one good thing that came out of it, to feed hungry kids. Let me get to the amendments. The amendments, we had a little group that kind of got together and we talked about it, and ODE was at that meeting. The first section gives out money to reimburse programs that currently have or start up programs with 85 or above poverty level. So if you already have a program, this is an incentive to keep the program. If you don't have a program, and I believe there was only one school above 85% that doesn't have any program, it would be an incentive to start a program and get a little higher reimbursement rate than the feds give you. The second section was something that we kind of thought up late Friday. Cindy Hunt and I did, and that's why I called Mickey Lansing, and I'm here to tell you that she agrees with this section. We were trying to think of a way that we wanted the schools that have over 70% poverty rate, to get together with their community partners and talk about how can we make this work, how can we have more programs, what part would you have, what part would we have. We have to pay Teamsters to drive this food to the sites. Maybe we could do it with volunteer drivers and make it more cost effective. So in order to have those meetings and not have yet another unfunded mandate, Sydney and I kind of put our heads together and came up with the local Commission on Children and Families have community meetings already. And so we put together the language to say you will have it on your agenda by next summer, and you will discuss this and discuss summer food programs and how you'll work together. And then we go on to say that districts will have somebody at that meeting, and they have to have a representative, and that's really important because some of the very, very rural districts, now I'm representing OSB and COSA, some of the really, really rural districts obviously don't have a lot of community partners nearby. So how do you do that? Well, maybe their ESD represents them in that area. Maybe they all go together and get a nutritionist at the ESD level. So somebody from the ESD could go represent many of those really rural communities at that meeting. So we wanted to try to make it effective for everybody and not onerous. And then the section on the task force was really meant, the department currently has a group that meets, and it was really meant to become one of their sort of new projects or duties, is to take care of these kinds of things. So it really, that way they didn't have a fiscal impact either, because it's an existing group. We were trying to keep, if this gets funded at $49,000, I want every penny of it to go for food for the kids, not a staff member to hold a meeting. That's just not my idea of feeding hungry kids. Talking is, you know, gets you there, but we tried to do the amendment so that there was no fiscal impact for any of the agencies or districts, and that all of the money went straight to the kids, to districts, to reimburse for meals as an incentive to keep their programs or start a new one. And with that, you can ask me any questions.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Bakke.
Money matters aside, do we really need the task force or advisory group or anything like that from your perspective?
Chair Backlund, Representative Bakke, and I think that I don't think you need a new one. There is an existing one, and I think that the summer food programs and the questions that sort of ask them to consider is a good thing. I mean, I think that they need to consider these. I know that it was really brought to light for me and for my superintendent that this is an issue, and our nutrition services people knew it, but you don't always get it up to the higher level.
My question was not phrased very well.
Oh, okay. Oh.
Do you really think that we need in statute to identify the task force or advisory group like we have with this amendment?
Representative Avakian, that I believe that others believe that it needs to be in statute. I'm not sure that I believe it, but that I don't have a problem with it the way it's written at all.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm Patty Whitney Wise with the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force, and we, of course, are in support of this bill as well. We have been part of the group working on amendments to make it acceptable to the education community. And just prior to this hearing, we did meet with representatives from the Department of Education who did have some concerns about this whole new section on a task force that seems to create something new. If you would like, we can easily, right after this hearing, work on the amendments that would, in fact, make it an advisory group. Really, it would just be taking Section 3, changing it to advisory group, and getting rid of Section 4 on, or subset 4 on in that section, to give the department enough flexibility to, like Patty is saying, incorporate it into something that already exists within the department rather than creating something new. Mm-hmm. So that's what we would propose. Currently, we only serve about 15% of the kids who receive school breakfast and lunch with the summer program. So we have a long way to go. This is really a step in the right direction. I would encourage you to pass this bill as soon as possible so that it will be effective this summer and we can help kids right away. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if we can, I shouldn't say we, I probably should say you, but if this can be worked out, we'll bring this back on Friday and see if we can move the bill on, because I think probably we pretty much are in consensus that this is a good thing. Okay, thank you very much. With that, then, I think we should close the work session on Senate Bill 130, and we'll adjourn the meeting.